From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Chloe Wittenberg.
And I'm Jared Nolan.
This week on War News Radio, Resisting Change, we first hear about the implications of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq.
Danger now is that hostility carried by militia groups and other extremist groups against the United States and Iraq will lead to the U.S. embassy being isolated and not being able to build a relationship that's healthy and extends in a way that goes beyond the military-to-military relationship between the Iraq and the United States.
Then, we learn about the Lord's Resistance Army, a militia terrorizing Central Africa.
They took some 20 women out of a displacement camp with their babies on their backs, lay them in the grass in the bush, and then they smashed in the brains of the women and the babies in the grass and left their bodies there uncovered.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
A NATO airstrike killed 24 Pakistani soldiers along the Afghan-Pakistan border in what United States Defense and State Department officials maintain was a case of mistaken identity. While the chairman of the U.S. Military Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, says the attack was not intentional, Pakistan Army General Ashfaq Nadeem calls the assault a deliberate act of aggression. The incident has prompted Pakistan to block NATO supplies and troops from crossing the border into Pakistan. Pakistan has also demanded that U.S. troops leave Shamsi Air Base within 15 days. Pakistan has also threatened to withdraw attendance from the upcoming Bonn Conference, in which 75 nations are gathering to discuss the security of Afghanistan. NATO and the U.S. military have pledged to conduct thorough investigations into the incident.
The attack comes at a strategically inopportune moment. Even as the U.S. troop drawdown in Afghanistan requires increased Pakistani support, diplomatic relations between the two countries have deteriorated since U.S. forces crossed the Pakistani border to assassinate Osama bin Laden. At the same time, American critics of Pakistan, including Senator John McCain, say Pakistan supports militants operating in the region. Pakistan has been a U.S. ally during the war in Afghanistan since 2001 and received substantial aid money from the U.S.
Turkey has followed the Arab League, the United States, and the European Union in establishing sanctions on the Syrian government. Turkey's trade with Syria was estimated at $2.4 billion last year, and the sanctions include freezes on assets held by members of government, halting transactions with Syria's central bank, and travel bans on 17 key figures in the Syrian government. The Arab League, excluding Lebanon and Iraq, agreed to similar measures earlier, and also planned to stop all flights going into Damascus. The sanctions came in response to Syrian President Bashar Assad's refusal to allow 500 monitors from the Arab League into Syria to assess the conditions for civilians on the ground. Meanwhile, the United Nations has released a report accusing the Syrian government of crimes against humanity, including the murder of at least 256 children at the hands of military forces. Testimony from government defectors in the report also say that men and boys in custody were sexually assaulted, that troops were ordered to shoot unarmed protesters, and that those who refused were killed. The sanctions are intended to weaken support for Assad, and are aimed at bringing down the government within 6 to 9 months.
Hundreds of Iranians, allegedly students, stormed the British embassy in Tehran. Approximately 1,000 rioters overpowered Iranian police and the British embassy guard. Over 20 protesters and British officials were injured, but no deaths were reported. The United Kingdom's announcement of strict economic sanctions in response to Iran's nuclear program reportedly sparked the demonstration. The UK has evacuated all of its diplomatic staff from Iran and also expelled all of Iran's diplomatic staff from the UK, shutting down the embassy. Several other European nations have also closed their embassies or removed their ambassadors in response.
Israeli military officials report that several rockets launched from Lebanon struck northern Israel. According to the Lebanese National News Agency, Israel returned fire soon after the initial attack. While both sides report material damage, there have been no reported casualties, and an escalation of hostilities does not seem likely. Lebanese President Michel Suleiman has condemned the strikes, saying such actions do not show solidarity with the Palestinian people. Likewise, Israeli military officials have planned a limited response. Since the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah, a militant group based in Lebanon, there's been only sporadic violence along the Lebanon-Israel border. Abdullah Azzam Brigades, a little-known Islamist group, is claiming responsibility for this attack.
Baghdad's Green Zone experienced its first suicide attack in 4 years. The suicide car bomb detonated next to the Iraqi parliament building. 5 people were killed. However, the reported target of the attack, Speaker of Parliament Osama al-Nujaifi, was unharmed. The Iraqi and U.S. governments are currently negotiating a continued U.S. military presence after the withdrawal concludes this month. Later in this program, War News Radio's Max Nesterak will look into the U.S. role in Iraq after the withdrawal.
Unrest continued in Cairo in anticipation of the parliamentary elections. Tens of thousands of protesters flocked to Tahrir Square to demonstrate against the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, the military leadership currently in control of Egypt. The Egyptians protested against the reluctance of the military to cede power to civilian government and vowed to occupy the square until the military steps down, something the White House is now calling for. The former interim Prime Minister, Assam Sharaf, resigned this week, and his military-appointed successor, Kamal Ghanzouri, served as Prime Minister under Mubarak during the 90s. Protesters cite this move as further evidence that the military is unresponsive to demands of the people. It is unclear whether the general population views the army as a source of stability in the country. One demonstrator was killed when he was run over by a police vehicle.
In spite of the violence in Tahrir Square last week, the first phase of the 3-month election for the new Egyptian parliament began peacefully with a record turnout. The election is the first free parliamentary ballot for more than 80 years and follows 3 decades of corrupt elections under former President Hosni Mubarak's rule. The election included a third of Egypt's provinces, including major cities such as Cairo and Alexandria. There were administrative delays, and some polling booths extended their hours to accommodate more voters. Thousands of volunteers from the Freedom and Justice Party, the political party of the Muslim Brotherhood, were present near polling booths to assist the voters. Many voters expressed hopes of a new democracy in Egypt, despite uncertainties concerning the fate of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, the interim military force in power since the ousting of Mubarak in January. Though the final results are not due until next January, preliminary results from the first 2 days of voting released by party representatives indicate that the Freedom and Justice Party holds the plurality of the vote. The Noor Party, the political party of the ultra-conservative Muslim Salafists, has received the next most votes.
Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh signed a deal relinquishing presidential power in exchange for immunity from prosecution. He will retain the honorary title of president, but official powers will be transferred to his deputy, Vice President Abdrabah Mansour Hadi, for the 90-day period leading up to early elections. Saleh's resignation comes after increasingly escalatory anti-government protests this year. Following Saleh's announcement, protests broke out in Yemen's capital against the power-sharing deal, with at least 5 protesters killed and 33 injured.
This is War News Radio. By the end of this year, the last 13,000 United States troops will return home from Iraq. While this marks the end to America's nearly 9-year presence in the country, the U.S. will continue to hold political, military, and economic interests in building a healthy diplomatic relationship with Iraq. As War News Radio's Max Nesterak examines, a tenuous U.S. relationship with the Iraqi parliament, growing tensions with Iran, and fears of a resurgence of al-Qaeda and other insurgent forces may continue when U.S. combat forces leave the ground.
At the end of October, United States President Barack Obama announced he would stick to the agreement signed with the Iraqi government in 2008.
Over the next 2 months, our troops in Iraq, tens of thousands of them, will pack up their gear and board convoys for the journey home.
But the lead-up to the end of the war hasn't gone completely as planned. The U.S. was unable to negotiate for criminal immunity for training units to continue operating in Iraq, or for 15,000 troops to stay past the end of the year to continue working with the Iraqi forces. And insurgent forces still exercise their influence with attacks in some regions.
The United States will continue to have an interest in an Iraq that is stable, secure, and self-reliant.
Yet while the war in Iraq appears to be ending, Obama has a dilemma. How can America support a stable Iraq while relations with the country are lukewarm and Americans seem to be tired of the war? One of the ways we're seeing this commitment is in the size of the U.S. Embassy, America's biggest, and roughly as large as the Vatican. However, it's unclear how successful this presence will be. In addition, some sources are citing the large presence of U.S. forces in neighboring Kuwait, from which they would be able to run special missions across the border. Another reason, though perhaps not as critical, for Obama to want to continue to support the Iraqi government after the withdrawal is that it coincides with the upcoming 2012 presidential elections. Ned Parker, the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, says any successes or failures of the Iraqi government in the coming year is likely to be thrown into the political arena.
Right now, part of the problem with the withdrawal is that it's the actual announcement and the drawdown is taking place during the run-up to the U.S. presidential campaign. So anything that happens involving the United States abroad of strategic value immediately becomes politicized.
On the other side, Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, says the outcome of the Iraqi war is irrelevant to the elections because the American populace is so tired with the war as a whole, and no one would have wanted us to stay longer.
You know, I think by the time that this has happened, it has become largely politically irrelevant. The left wing of the Democratic Party would have been upset if the U.S. hadn't been out of Iraq. So Obama might get some credit with his own left wing. The Republicans have attacked him for the withdrawal, saying that he's leaving Iraq in a parlous condition and unstable and open to Iranian influence.
But Cole says that leaves Republicans in the position of saying they wish the Iraq war could have been extended or that the U.S. military presence in Iraq could have been extended.
I don't think that's a popular campaigning point for anybody. I don't think most Republicans would find that an attractive offer. So the main political outcome of this withdrawal is that Obama might mollify some of his disgruntled left-wing base.
James Denslow, director of the New Diplomacy Platform and writer for The Guardian, says with the size of the U.S. embassy, we are seeing simply a recalibration of forces and methods in American strategy.
They are trying to plan for a long-term presence there where influence continues regardless of the numbers of U.S. troops on the ground. I think that in Iraq you have a failed state that has subsequently become a very weak and gridlocked state that has no ability from the central government perspective to exercise true sovereignty and effective sovereignty to the country's territorial limit.
Under those conditions, Denso says, terrorist groups will be able to continue organizing and planning attacks against U.S. interests in Iraq, and as a result, the U.S. will justify continued influence in the region by way of special forces or aerial attacks.
So what we're seeing here is a very unconventional presence, not a sovereign presence, not an occupation per se, but rather the continued use of influence through strategic nodes and tactics such as drones and special forces.
In addition, Denso says, the U.S. could use those methods to hedge against larger threats as they develop in neighboring Iran.
So it's a real reconfiguration of the presence in the country. It is not the U.S. leaving, goodbye, no more U.S. presence, nor influence in the country. Those are two very different things.
Parker says the U.S. shows its continued commitment to a healthy Iraq through the size of its embassy. However, the expected payoff for that effort may not be all that it was planned to be.
The danger now is that hostility carried by militia groups and other extremist groups against the United States and Iraq will lead to the U.S. embassy being isolated and not being able to build a relationship that's healthy and extends in a way that goes beyond the military-to-military relationship between the Iraq and the United States.
Parker says that the military relationship has been the backbone of the alliance between Iraq and the U.S. Cole says we're already seeing signs of a failed U.S. embassy in Iraq now.
The purpose of having a big embassy was presumably in hopes of continued heavy influence of Washington on Baghdad. It clearly hasn't worked. Otherwise, the Iraqis would not have declined to offer U.S. troops immunity and would not have, more or less, kicked the U.S. militarily out of Iraq.
The Status of Forces Agreement, or the Strategic Framework Agreement, was signed by the U.S. and Iraqi governments in 2008 and granted the U.S. special military privileges such as running counterterrorism operations and control of Iraqi airspace. But that expires at the end of the year. However, Parker says it's likely the Iraqi government will grant the U.S. some of those privileges under new agreements at that time. Parker cites several reports stating that there will be a large American presence in Kuwait, giving the U.S. capabilities to run special operations in Iraq. This happens in other countries already, Parker says, such as in Yemen, where there is a small number of counterterrorism forces on the ground.
So if the Iraqi government sees a need for American capabilities in attacking al-Qaeda or some other extremist group, I think there's a good bet the prime minister of Iraq would ask for a small group of U.S. forces to come in to help their Iraqi counterparts carry out a raid. They have a history doing this, the Iraqi counterterrorism forces.
According to Parker, that's the equivalent of U.S. special forces.
It's not inconceivable that a small U.S. troop presence could quietly come across the border to do a special operation at Iraq's request.
Denslow says he thinks we'll see an assertion of American influence, possibly different from how the Obama administration frames it, and possibly without as much collaboration with the Iraqi government as Parker anticipates.
I think Obama's policies in Iraq, you have to be carefully analyzed for the difference between the rhetoric and the reality. While the reality of a continued U.S. presence in different guises, whether it's through muscular diplomacy or private security contractors or counterterrorism methods such as the use of drone technology, will likely continue. The rhetoric defines the U.S. presence in Iraq as a far less overt occupier than it's ever been since 2003. So I believe Obama is essentially hedging his bets by maintaining a level and a degree of effective U.S. influence in the country while allowing the Iraqi body politic to assert a veneer of sovereignty that allows legitimacy to occur within the Iraqi body politic.
Cole says he doesn't think we'll see the kind of continued U.S. involvement in Iraq that others are predicting.
These talking points are those that one often encounters kind of on lefty bulletin boards, but they're incorrect. It's simply not the case. That is to say, you can't talk about a U.S. military presence in Iraq after December 31st if there aren't any troops there. It's just not the case that there will be very many U.S. troops, even in the Gulf more generally.
Cole says he finds the fear about private contractors strange because they would have to be hired by the Iraqi government, who could also subsequently fire them. He says there will be several private contractors attached to the U.S. embassy, but not many. Denslow says the war in Iraq is certainly not finished for the people who live there.
They are subject to a daily toll of violence that would be completely unacceptable in the West. The current rate of attacks is some 14 a day, but those attacks are roadside bombs, suicide vehicles, booby traps, houses even. There is a bloody price that is continued to being paid by the people of Iraq for the chaos that was unleashed by the 2003 invasion and the subsequent occupation. So despite the fact the U.S. has turned a page and created a new chapter in Iraq, for the Iraqi people, the struggle goes on.
This week, United States Vice President Joe Biden flew to Baghdad unannounced to meet with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to discuss future relations between the two countries. Biden said the withdrawal of American troops marks the beginning of a relationship that will not only benefit the U.S. and Iraq, but the entire region. In response to Biden's visit, supporters of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr rallied in Basra and Baghdad, chanting, "Biden, get out of town," and "No to America." Al-Maliki is scheduled to visit Obama at the White House later this December. For War News Radio, I'm Max Nesterak.
This is War News Radio. Since the later years of the 20th century, Africa has been scarred by civil wars and tribal fighting. In many of these conflicts, forces employing guerrilla tactics have wreaked havoc on civilian populations. War News Radio's Sam Hirschman reports on the history of one group in particular, the Lord's Resistance Army, and how they have recently attracted American attention.
The Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, has been labeled a terrorist group by the African Union, and its tactics appear to merit the classification. Professor Tim Allen of the London School of Economics describes one LRA attack in 2004.
They took some 20 women out of a displacement camp. with their babies on their backs, lay them in the grass, in the bush, and then they'd smashed in the brains of the women and the babies in the grass and left their bodies there uncovered.
United States President Barack Obama announced new American engagement in the conflict with the LRA in October and has sent 100 advisors to Uganda to help. This is not the first intervention by U.S. forces in the conflict, which has raged in Uganda since the late 1980s and has, more recently, spread to the Congo, South Sudan, and Central African Republic. The LRA arose as a resistance movement to Yoweri Museveni, who has been the president of Uganda since seizing power in a civil war in 1986. As Allen, who is also the co-editor of the book The Lord's Resistance Army, Myth and Reality, describes, Museveni's victory at the time sparked tribal tension against his government in northern Uganda.
In 1986, the current president, President Museveni, swept to power, and he overthrew a government that was mainly dominated by the Acholi people from northern Uganda. Many of the soldiers that were in the former army, the army that he overthrew in January 1986, they formed rebel groups that fought against Museveni's forces.
Against this backdrop, Joseph Kony founded a movement that combined Christian and traditional African spiritual beliefs and was committed to fighting Museveni's forces, eventually calling itself the Lord's Resistance Army. Allen says it has been flexible as a military group.
The LRA has been remarkable at adapting its military strategies. I mean, there's no doubt that Joseph Kony, and everyone says about him, you know, would be the first thing that Ugandan army officers would say. You know, he is a remarkable strategist.
Joseph Kony's mind for strategy has been turned violently against local populations. The LRA has been classified as a terrorist organization because of its strategic use of violence. Allen elaborates on the methods used by LRA forces.
It would go in and do things that were shocking and had a big impact on a big population, but maybe only affected quite a few people.
Allen recalls LRA strategies in northern Uganda.
They'd go into a village or a displacement camp, and maybe they'd mutilate two or three people, and maybe they'd abduct 20 children and maybe 50, 60 adults to carry, you know, weapons and food and so on, and then they'd disappear into the bush again. And then that would terrify the population.
The 30-year terror campaign has attracted American attention before. The U.S. provided intelligence and other support to Operation Lightning Thunder, a military mission led by the Ugandan army against the LRA's camp in the northern Congo in 2008. The goal of the operation was to capture Kony and cripple the LRA. But, as Professor Cohen Vlassenroot, director of the Conflict Research Group and co-editor of The Lord's Resistance Army, Myth and Reality, describes, the operation was unsuccessful.
Just before the start of the campaign, Kony was informed about this and could escape. And then there was this air campaign was followed by an operation of ground troops, but they came only 3 days after. By that time, most of the LRA had left already.
Operation Lightning Thunder had a few consequences. The first was a retaliatory campaign by the LRA against civilians. The second was a change in tactic that Vlassenroot says made the LRA more amorphous.
From then on, it has been operating in very small units with limited communication between them, but very active in a territory as large as the state of California. So quite big operational capacity still, even with a limited number of people.
How limited is limited? According to Vlassenroot, the group is very small.
Something like between 300 and 400 combatants.
The governments of Uganda, South Sudan, the Congo, and Central African Republic are working together to eliminate the LRA. The attempts to fight the LRA have proven to be quite costly for the people of those nations. The LRA can strike and then seemingly disappear back into the jungle from which they came. Allen says this has earned them a frightening name in the local language, Ulum, which means the bush.
People talk about the people of the bush, the people who turn moral space upside down, bring the frightening forces of the bush into the home and turn things around in ways that are deeply frightening, the stuff of nightmares, you know, making children kill their parents, do terrible things, and so on. So I mean, that creates a kind of a moral space that's sort of outside that of the normal community, and that too becomes a logic of its own.
While the LRA is currently small, in part due to constant operations against it since the early 90s, it remains unclear what the consequence of a new campaign would be. If Kony is captured, the group might dissolve. Then again, it might not. Vlasenroot says the local population will bear the brunt of the retaliation because there are no defensive structures in place. Vlasenroot wonders why negotiation with the LRA has been abandoned.
This reduction to a military strategy, which is very unlikely to be successful, I think is rather problematic. During the peace process in Juba, these 3 years were quite calm on the ground. This was a period that did not cause a lot of impact on the local population. It was a rather peaceful moment.
Vlasenroot thinks attempts at peace were given up too quickly.
And that was only 3 years. We didn't give it a lot of a chance.
It appears, however, that the Ugandan government and its neighbors prefer military options, and the U.S. is willing to support them. If they do not succeed in eliminating the LRA, previous failures have shown that non-combatants will pay the price. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Natalia Choi, Amy DePiro, Amandine Lee, Colin Smith, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Chloe Wittenberg.
And I'm Jared Nolan. To play us out, we have a new song from Cobble Dreams, an up-and-coming Afghan band that War News Radio interviewed last year. You can find this song, Sadeiman, and many more on their YouTube account, Cobble Dreams. Until next time, thanks for listening. به درمان نیست قصه و زمزمش چون این آسان نیست همچو یک داروی تر لحظه راحت و دستگیر یا بیر